And there's one question from last week, and then we'll see if you guys have some questions. Okay, so Gendon last week asked, okay, as we become more reliable, both for ourselves and others, how do we work through the boxes it seems everybody already has placed us in? Okay, even though they are just another person's labels, sometimes they can feel difficult to overcome. Okay, so, you know, it's on the topic of joyous effort, and so you're changing and you're becoming more reliable, but your family members and your old friends, you know, they just think you're the same old person, and they have an image of you that is like a box, and they just keep expecting you to do the same old things and treating you as if you're going to do the same old things. And so you feel like saying, hey, I'm a different person, I'm changing, give me some credit, don't put me in that box, you know, I'm learning to be more reliable, I'm more responsible now, don't always assume I'm going to bungle it, yeah. So sometimes it, you know, actually I think this is one of the reasons why they say when you're doing a lot of intense practice, they say leave your homeland. You know the verse in the 37 practices? Because sometimes when you're in your quote-unquote homeland with the people who have known you for a long time, then it becomes hard to change because they have such rigid images of you. So sometimes, you know, I think that's one of the reasons it says kind of go to a different place where you're with new people who don't know you, who don't have those boxes. Yeah. Otherwise, you know, if you're in any case, you know, even if it's your family, even if you go somewhere else, you're still going to come back and visit your family. So the thing to do is to just be really clear yourself, you know, and just know, okay, they have an old thing. But as I start acting in a more responsible way, eventually they will see it. Yeah, I mean, people with eyes will see. And so even if they keep treating me like I'm going to make the same old mistakes, just, you know, let it go. Don't make it in my mind something that, oh, they don't have confidence in me, so it's okay if I make the same old mistake because they expect me to, so I might as well, I don't need to try. Don't think like that. That's not a good way to think, you know, because you're trying to change because you have your own sense of integrity. So, you know, you go about changing, and then eventually people will see it. Yeah. Okay, now, other questions? Yeah.
Well, first I have one about the Buddha, well, actually about these different jhanas.
Uh-huh.
It seems like they're the same ones that are described in the Pali Canon that the Buddha eventually became enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
Do they think the same way about it as what you just described?
Yeah.
Or didn't he just end up in one of the jhanas?
Okay, so in the Pali Canon when it talks about how the Buddha practiced before attaining enlightenment, yes, he went through all these jhanas. Mm-hmm. Yeah? Because the thing is, when you develop special insight, meditating on emptiness, you have to do it with a mind of concentration. So you do develop these jhanas. And the Buddha was very flexible. He had all of them. He could go up and down and, you know, in and out of different meditative absorptions, you know, like this. So it was a very good skill, you know, especially if you to become a Buddha and you're going to, you know, emanate many bodies. Yeah, so yes, the Buddha did practice this before he became enlightened, but he had the bodhicitta motivation. Okay, and so that's why he was able to use it to realize selflessness. Yeah, and yes, the Pali Canon has the same take on the importance of doing the jhana practices with a mind of renunciation. Yeah.
So you get all of those jhanas on the bodhisattva path?
On the bodhisattva path, the jhanas are the four ones in the form realm, and then you have the four meditative absorptions in the formless realm. The bodhisattvas, because they're going to be working for the benefit of sentient beings, they have to develop much more versatility in their levels of concentration than the hearers and solitary realizers, because bodhisattvas are going to use their various states of samadhi to make emanations to send out for the benefit of sentient beings, to make emanations to go to pure lands, to make offerings. Yeah, so the bodhisattvas, they do spend a lot of time meditating, you know, on all these different states, and then developing. We're going to get, there's later on another classification, what is it here, mundane and super mundane meditative stabilizations. So the mundane ones are what ordinary people develop, and then the super mundane ones are ones that Aryas develop. Okay, so like in the Heart Sutra, you know, the Buddha was on the in the concentration of the
countless aspects of
yeah, the countless aspects of phenomena. So there was, you know, there's that samadhi. Then there's all sorts of other samadhis that the bodhisattvas can enter into, in which they're developing different capabilities. Yeah. And on the, what is it, I think it's on the seventh bhumi, then they can go in and out of meditative stabilizations just like this. You know, I mean, it's very difficult to do. Yeah. Are our friends online?
Yeah. Actually, we did just get a question.
Uh-huh.
Spokane Dharma.
Okay.
When you were talking of the mind in the formless realm,
uh-huh.
Was that the mind or mind stream?
Oh, so and when I was talking about the mind and the formless realm, is it the mind or the mind stream? It's the same thing. Yeah? Mind stream just means one moment of mind after the next. Okay?
They say that the three higher trainings build upon each other.
Uh-huh.
And that the more that you practice ethical discipline and really take care of your precepts and follow them purely, that the natural consequence is your ability to actually be able to concentrate.
Mm-hmm.
When does that happen?
Okay. So the venerable nun is asked, who's been ordained how many months? She's is saying that they say that the three higher trainings build on each other. Okay, and so they say that by practicing ethical discipline and keeping your precepts, then it helps you to develop concentration. And so she's asking, when will that happen? Okay. So it doesn't happen like this. Okay, but what happens is to keep our precepts. First of all, when you keep precepts, you behave better. When you behave better, you don't have as much regret. Okay? Regret is a distraction when you're trying to develop meditation, isn't it? You start thinking of all the terrible things you said and things you did, and you feel so bad, and your mind's stuck in the past. Okay? So that's why we do a lot of purification to get rid of that. But when you keep precepts, then you stop creating more of that. Yeah. So then you don't have all those distractions between, oh, I said this awful thing to somebody, and I hurt somebody's feelings, and I created this negative karma and that negative karma. Okay, so it stops all that kind of regret. Also, when you keep precepts, you know, you're cutting off a lot of avenues of creating negative karma. So you have less negative karmas to sit and plan for. You know, because if you're really trying to keep your precepts well, so for example, you're trying not to speak harshly to others, yeah, and you're really working on you know, not speaking harshly. And in our monastic precepts, there's several precepts that you break if you speak harshly to other people, okay. And so then you say, oh, if I'm going to keep these precepts with my mouth, then I have to work on the mind. That likes to speak harshly, that likes to retaliate or dump my frustration out on someone else. Okay, so you start thinking about that in your meditation and working with the mind in order to not do that action. And as the mind calms down, then you stop getting distracted so much by thoughts of revenge, you know, and wishes to give somebody a taste of their own medicine and so on and so forth. Because when that thought comes in your mind, you stop yourself and you say, no, that's not a virtuous thought. I don't want to be thinking that. Because if I think that, I'm going to be, you know, it'll lead me to speak in a way to somebody that I don't want to speak in. Okay, so it helps in that way too. Also, to keep our precepts, we're developing, we're strengthening two mental factors. One is mindfulness and the other is alertness. Alertness, a lot of the Pali translators translate it as clear comprehension or clear knowing. Okay? But the Tibetans translate it as alertness, vigilance, introspection. Okay, it's one of these mental factors that does a lot of different things, actually. Okay, but when you're to keep your precepts, you need mindfulness. So you need the ability to know what you want your body and speech to do, and to keep your mind on how you want your body and speech to be. Okay. So you're mindful of your actions of body speech. And then you're developing alertness, which is a kind of introspective ability to say, well, what's going on? What's happening in my mind? What's happening with my body? What's happening with my speech? Okay? So you become more self-aware and you become more mindful of the way you want to behave. Okay, so you're developing those two mental factors in order to keep your precepts. Okay, because if you're not mindful of your precepts, then you're going to break them. Yeah, and if you don't have any kind of alertness, then you know you act in very, very reckless ways. Okay, so you're developing those two qualities to develop. Sila, you know, your ethical conduct. Those two mental factors are also important ones when it comes to developing concentration, the second higher training. But there, the mindfulness is on your object to meditation, and the alertness is seeing if you're still on your object to meditation or not. Okay? So by keeping good ethical conduct, you're already strengthening those two mental factors. So then when you start developing concentration, those mental factors have some strength already. Okay, we have to stop. We're over time.